This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, Ajamu Baraka talks about the Clinton campaign's dirty politics and lies about the Greens. The Black is Back Coalition gathers in Philadelphia for a conference on self-determination and a courtroom victory in defense of public education in Detroit. But first, one of the ways the Republicans and Democrats keep their monopoly on U.S. electoral politics is by excluding third parties from the televised presidential debates. The two major parties jointly own the so-called Commission on Presidential Debates, which excludes parties that fail to register 15% in the polls. However, veteran journalist Sam Husseini says the polling organizations are asking a trick question. Instead of asking people who they want to become president, they ask people who they plan to vote for on Election Day, which is a very different question. That was Sam Husseini of Vote Pact in Washington. The Clinton campaign has deployed its internet trolls and slander-slinging operatives to besmirch the good names of Jill Stein and Ajamu Baraka on the Green Party's presidential ticket. Baraka is a veteran activist, a founder of the U.S. Human Rights Network, and an editor and columnist for Black Agenda Report. He was recently interviewed by Eric Dreitzer of Counterpunch Radio. Baraka says so-called liberals are doing much of the dirty work for the corporate war hawk Hillary Clinton. Green Party vice presidential candidate Ajamu Baraka on Counterpunch Radio. The Black is Back Coalition for Social Justice, Peace, and Reparations held a conference in Philadelphia this month to put the finishing touches on a new document that puts forward a comprehensive list of demands within the context of Black self-determination. This Black Agenda for Self-Determination covers 19 points, from Black community control of police to an anti-imperialist foreign policy. The agenda will be submitted to various state conventions and then for approval at a national conference in Washington in November. Black is Back Chairman Omali Yeshitela recounted how the coalition was formed back in 2009. Black is Back Coalition Chairman Omali Yeshitela. Ralph Pointer, the veteran activist and husband of people's lawyer and former political prisoner Lynn Stewart, heads up the Black is Back Coalition's Political Prisoners Working Group. Ralph Pointer, speaking at the Black is Back Coalition Conference on Self-Determination in Philadelphia. In Detroit, a Michigan judge has upheld activists' right to agitate against the privatization of the city's public schools. Former Teachers Union President Steve Kahn and Nicole Conaway of BAM, by any means necessary, had called for a massive sick-out and strike by teachers. We spoke with Steve Kahn. He said the judge ruled that he and Conaway were just exercising their right to free speech.
There's no major poll that I know of that asks the American public who they want to be president. Every poll, and certainly the five that the Presidential Debate Commission, this bipartisan creation, uses, asks the question, if the election were held today, a false hypothetical, who would you vote for? One of the problems with that is that that just simply replicates the bind that the voter is in, given our electoral system. Certainly there are many people who are planning on voting for third party candidates. Jill Stein, even in these polls, is polling at, 5-6%. Gary Johnson is polling close to 10% in some of these. But I argue that there are probably millions more people who would want to vote for these individuals or other third parties, but don't plan on doing so because of the whole fear factor. The main attraction to people at the prospect of voting for Hillary Clinton is to stop Donald Trump. The main attraction of people planning on voting for Donald Trump is to stop Hillary Clinton. These two figures have created a mutual prison for the American voter, and it's based on the voting system. Polls should be a way of getting out from that. These polls call themselves, and are called by the Presidential Debate Commission, public opinion polls. They don't measure opinion. They are non-opinion polls. They purport to figure out what a future action will be and extenuate the imprisonment of the American voter rather than actually gauging public opinion.
In other words, if you ask a person, who do you plan to vote for president, that person may be one who agrees with the principles of the Green Party, but has already decided to hold their nose and vote for Hillary Clinton. And that would not be a personal preference response that you got, but a reluctant decision on the part of the voter to vote for the person that they believe will defeat Trump.
Correct. You, in effect, have a vicious cycle that the polling question, because of that very reason, in effect, drives down the level of support for the Green Party, for the Libertarian Party, for others, and that marginalizes the amount of support that they have in the polls, because that's cited as the reason for a lack of coverage, and it's also cited as a reason for exclusion from the presidential debate. The Presidential Debate Commission says that you need to be at 15%. Now, there's an interesting additional level to this with the Presidential Debate Commission. Several years ago, a group of people got together and said, no, this 15% threshold is overly exclusionary. You need to have other ways. For example, they argued that you should make it so that if a majority of the American public wanted somebody to be in the debates, that should be another way of somebody, you know, getting a place on the stage. The heads of the Presidential Debate Commission both responded to that, and they both said, no, that's a ridiculous idea. The only relevant question is who you want to be president. They actually used those words. So they, the Presidential Debate Commission themselves, have asked that criteria, who do you want to be president, be the basis for inclusion in the presidential debate that they organize. But that's not the question that they're using. They're using these polls by ABC, CBS, NBC, New York Times, and so on, none of which ask that question. They all ask that question, if the election were held today, who would you vote for? So this tactical maneuver that many voters feel like they have to do, you know, I don't want Hillary Clinton, I don't like Hillary Clinton, but I feel like I got to vote for her to stop Trump, that's in effect being used to drive down gauged level of support for third parties and is a mechanism for excluding them from the debates.
And as you said, the two major party candidates' disapproval levels are so high that if one asked the question, who is your first choice to be president, or who do you want to be president, neither one would get many affirmatives on those polls.
Yeah, we could. I mean, theoretically, we could have majority appeal for a third party candidate even right now with the minimal media coverage and the slanted media coverage and so on that they've gotten, but we'd never know it because nobody's asking the American public that question. I mean, there's a whole litany of ways. If these were serious public opinion polls, they could, for example, ask in terms of instant runoff voting, rate the following candidates, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Nobody's doing that. I think an even better way to phrase the question would be, the following candidates are all in a four-way tie: Hillary Clinton, Donald Trump, Gary Johnson, and Jill Stein. You have the tie-breaking vote. Who do you vote for? Phrasing the question that way would get at what I would call close to absolute preference, you know, who the person really wants, without being trapped into these machinations of, I got to vote for this person because I don't want that person. We're never getting to what the public opinion actually is.
Well, we can understand why Democrats and Republicans who phrase the question that way, but why these major polling organizations violate their own logic, their own principles, their own best practices to phrase the question in such a way?
I've been meaning to research how this question came about. I presume that the rationale for it, in my limited conversations with mainstream pollsters, is that, well, we're trying to predict how the election's going to come out. It's a tracking poll. We're trying to predict what the outcome will be. But their phraseology is having policy implications between now and then. It's being used to exclude from the debates. It's being used to mold the media coverage. They're not public opinion polls. So I'm not sure exactly how it came about, and I hope to dig into that. But it becomes another layer. I mean, it's the same hypocrisy of, you know, the major media are supposed to reflect reality and so on. They don't. They mold it through a whole series of biases. So we, in effect, see a similar pattern in the world of major polling.
And, of course, there is no mystery why the Commission on Presidential Debates phrases the question that way and makes that argument, because the Commission is, in fact, a creature of the Republicans and the Democrats.
Precisely. As several other writers have documented, the Presidential Debate Commission was created by the establishment of the Democratic and Republican parties to exclude third-party candidates and others unless they both agreed that they wanted them on, as was the case when Perot was on. They, in effect, took over the debating role from the League of Women Voters, and the League of Women Voters turned away from the, you know, they called this a farcical process. And said that they would have no part in it. I think they called it a fraud on the American voter. So the lineage of this is very well established.
And in fact, the commission doesn't even refer to these debates as debates, but by some technical language that boils down to joint publicity appearances by candidates.
Right, joint media appearances or something like that. Yeah, it's quite brazen if you dig into it. And utterly choreographed in terms of who can do what, when, you know, when you can respond. They come up with these agreements that are dozens of pages long, stipulating how it is. It's not a free flow of ideas. It's sort of calculated to ensure that nothing happens, or at least that's the way it's been. But the overall issue of selection, of exclusion of candidates, very well established.
Well, the broadcast and cable networks swear up and down that they are not creatures of the Democratic and Republican parties. Jeff Cohn has written an article recently that puts the onus on them to refuse to go along by these rigged rules cooked up by this Commission on Presidential Debates, which is really the Republican and Democratic parties.
Yes, I think the Group Roots Action put out an action alert trying to get that to happen. That is to turn the matter over to the networks and say, do an alternative besides the Commission on Presidential Debates and invite all four candidates who, you know, are on enough ballots to win. And if Clinton and Trump don't show up, just have an empty podium. That is what happened when Carter refused to be in the debate when the League of Women Voters had John Anderson on in 1980. Carter didn't want that. He didn't show up, and they just had a debate between Reagan and John Anderson. So there would be precedent for that. It's just that the networks are so tied in to the whole apparatus. As you say, with due skepticism, the networks say that they're not biased. The mantra, it's just a feeding of hate. MSNBC is spouting hatred against Republicans nonstop. Fox News is spouting hatred against Democrats nonstop. It's an entire media mechanism designed to, in effect, keep the two bases on the reservation and perpetuate fear in both of them so that those two bases vote for the nominees of each of those parties.
Interesting enough, those white liberals are trying to take me to task for my persistent critical analysis of their own racism, their own commitment to upholding white supremacy. You know, and as you know, I've been raising that issue because it continues to be the Achilles heel of the radical movement here in this country. And if we don't address these issues of white supremacy, then we're not going to ever be in a position to really advance a radical agenda. And so I think my critiques have been principled. but they are using my comments to try to suggest that I'm some type of anti-white, you know, black supremacist. And that's understandable. We accept that, you know. But the other line of attack that they are starting to create now, too, is that now that I'm some type of anti-Semitic, you know, and this and that. I mean, that, you know, Glenn Ford said something today that was very interesting. He said that, you know, anti-Semitism is their McCarthyism. That's the tool they pull out when they are really threatened by someone or some movement. So it's been a very interesting sort of phenomenon to watch unfold. But you know what? They don't understand that the people at this point aren't going to fall for these kinds of smear campaigns. People are looking for an alternative. And I think because people have respect for me and have a sense of my principles and what I stand for, I don't think that any of these attacks are going to stick. Now, they may stick with folks who don't know, because, you know, when the propagandists come out, they are very effective in just simplifying and putting certain words together to paint a picture. But, you know, we're gonna strike back. We're going to struggle, because right now the terms are too important to allow these liberal propagandists, these Clinton supporters, you know, to win the day.
That's definitely correct. But I want to just nail this down, because I think it is absolutely critical that we get a direct answer, a direct position on this issue. And I bring it up because, as I said already, I know you on a personal level. So I don't need you to tell me that not only are you not anti-Semitic, that you don't deny the Holocaust or any of these other nonsensical things that are going around now, but specifically that you have dedicated your life, I mean your life, to fighting against exactly those same cultural, you know, degeneracy, that same cultural degeneracy that you see in the form of white supremacy and in the form of fascism. And that's exactly the point here, is they're trying to smear you as somehow this like pseudo fascist with who God knows what kind of conspiracy theories and whatever. And what I'm getting at is, A, not only are you not that, but B, you have now become sort of this lightning rod that's exposing what is clear to all of us and has been from the very beginning, that liberalism in the United States is in fact the left flank of white supremacy, that they are inherently upholding white supremacy, and that the smears against you are a perfect illustration of what liberal racism looks like. And it needs to be said, and it needs to be said explicitly, because these people are not only shameful propagandists, they are in fact the enemy.
Well, I think you just said it, Eric. I mean, it, you know, liberalism and liberalism is morally bankrupt. I mean, that's absolutely clear. And what they are trying to do now is to try to undermine the moral authority that we have as a campaign that's developing to stand up for the working class here in this country, to advance a notion of our, to advance principles that transcend the limitations of liberalism, to talk about, you know, a new kind of democracy and an economic liberation of the people that goes beyond the limitations of capitalism. You know, so they have to undermine this movement morally, and the best, and so they find different ways of doing that. And of course, the sort of loony left narrative is one of the ways in which they try to undermine these kinds of oppositional moments. But, you know, when this is not going to be successful, I mean, because again, as I said, you know, people are looking for an alternative. People understand what they saw at the DNC a few weeks ago. They are getting a sense that this country continues to move to the right. They feel that their participation in this so-called democracy appears to be without real meaning and value, and they are thinking critically. I mean, when you look at polls that say that young people are seriously considering what socialism means and seriously considering socialism as an alternative. That's the kind of stuff that strikes fear in their hearts. That's why they have to undermine this campaign, because they know that we have a demographic that is moving toward this oppositional motion. They know that we are connected to the Black Lives Matter movements and all of the progressive movements here in this country. And we want to have a conversation with those movements to see, you know, if they believe that part of the strategy for advancing and building this progressive, this radical social bloc might include an electoral component, that perhaps this might be an instrument for that. So we want to have those kinds of principled, honest conversations. Again, this is not just about a campaign and us winning. We want to have votes because we want to have the ability to have the Green Party on the ballots as we go forward across the country. But this is an engagement. This is a conversation. This is a in-house struggle, if you will, among real active, real revolutionary and radicals around how we build and advance popular power. And that's the theme of this campaign. It is a commitment to making power to the people real.
We were compelled to come together for a number of reasons, not the least of which was the election of Barack Hussein Obama some 8 months prior, and a concern by many of the founders of the coalition that many people around the world and inside this country would be confused by the fact that imperialism, U.S. imperialism, historically characterized by white nationalism, rape and plunder of the non-white people around the world, would now have a black face. We were concerned because there were people all around the world who have known of the struggle of our people historically and have recognized that we have always been on the side of social justice, of peace, and we have always been opposed to oppression, not only our own oppression, but oppression of the peoples around the world. We have seen incidents historically where people who were fighting against U.S. imperialism would acknowledge publicly that they recognized that Africans in this country were not a part of the aggression of the United States government against their peoples. An extraordinary example was in 1979, when the people of Iran rose up and overturned the government that was supported, put in place by the United States government of the Shah of Iran. And at that point where they had captured the U.S. embassy that they correctly characterized as a nest of spies, they offered the African people who were there an opportunity to leave because they recognized the historical relationship of our oppression to their own oppression and exploitation. This has been something that was historically true, and now, finally, we have this representative of white power who has a black face. He looks just like most of the oppressed peoples around the world, but he's carrying out a white nationalist agenda. So it became a real concern. It became a concern because many of the people who we knew, who had gained reputations in the past era of significant struggle as being against imperialism, being against capitalism, who called themselves black nationalists and socialists and sometimes black communists, who called themselves people who were parts of movement for social justice, were deeply in the camp of Barack Hussein Obama, who revealed that they were against an oppression as long as it came in a white face. But the arrival of Obama seemed to suggest to many of them that there, but by the grace of God, go I. And they saw the election of Barack Hussein Obama as a path forward for aspiring African petty bourgeois forces, and they were deeply in his camp. We had a situation where many Africans throughout this country were in a state of near hysteria because of the election of Barack Hussein Obama. And so there were several of us who felt like it was absolutely necessary for our community to make a profound statement that it didn't matter to us what color the representative of white power happened to be. It didn't matter to us color, gender, black, white, male, female, homosexual, heterosexual. Imperialism is imperialism, and we had to make a statement that African people needed to know that it is permissible to be opposed to U.S. imperialism, even if it does have a black face. So on September 12th in Washington, D.C., we pulled together a meeting of several African groups and personalities and institutions that had demonstrated, many of them, opposition to the direction of U.S. imperialism, even as it was articulated by Barack Hussein Obama. We pulled together a meeting of people who came from the Muslim community that was being held in detention, Africans and Muslims being held in detention throughout this country and then stuck on occupied Cuban territory, Guantanamo base. And many people who were just ordinary folk. And interestingly, some of whom were actually supporters of Obama, but who had real problems with the direction of U.S. policy. We came together and we created the Black is Back Coalition for Social Justice, Peace, and Reparations. And indicated that the first action that we would take as a coalition would be on November, I think it was November 7th, where we called for a national rally, march on the White House, and a conference in opposition to the Obama regime. It was to be the first national mobilization against Barack Hussein Obama's regime. It was to be the first African mobilization against the Barack Hussein Obama regime. And the coalition, I think, right now, proudly hold that up as just an incredibly significant event. I think that we felt at the time that it didn't matter if masses of people did support this guy, because we recognized that what we were dealing with was a consequence that we still struggling to correct of a black liberation movement of the 1960s having been crushed. That whole process that assassinated Malcolm X, assassinated Martin Luther King, that destroyed effectively the Black Panther Party. I'm talking about the original Black Panther Party that had arrested scores and actually hundreds of people swept up off the streets of this country and then replaced this movement with charlatans and hustlers who were in bed with U.S. imperialism, even if from time to time they led a liberal protest or something to that effect. So we had masses of people without the benefit of leadership. There was no Malcolm X. There was no effective Black Panther Party. There was no revolutionary organization that could provide leadership to the masses of our people. So masses of people fell back on the Democratic Party and its representatives, which come in various different forms, and other liberal and middle class back black leadership and the ruling class media for leadership. And what that leadership told us was that the best thing that we had going for us was the fact that Barack Hussein Obama had been selected, and I say selected, purposely had been selected to become the new president of the United States, a man who came to that seat with the largest amount of money contributed to the candidate from Wall Street than any candidate in history, who actually had something like a $1 billion campaign fund to put himself forward to the world, and who won the loyalty of African people who were so tired of being described by white power, by the bourgeois media as incompetent, as unable to even speak in clear sentences and what have you. And Africans had this vicarious and in many ways incipient nationalist kind of response to the selection of Barack Hussein Obama. Africans voted for this man. It was important for African people to see this black man standing up with all of these white people being quite articulate in the face of them and clearly seeming to be somebody through whom they could show the world that African people were competent indeed. And so this vicarious relationship we had with Barack Hussein Obama was something that swept the masses of African people into accepting the same imperialist policies that George W. Bush had put forward and against which they clearly were willing to demonstrate opposition. So the coalition came together and we did this first action. And it was an important thing that we did because when we called for this mobilization against Obama, it was one of the things that helped to winnow out forces who were incapable of speaking for the interests of black people when opposition to our interests was in the black face. And it says something about the kind of coalition that we would begin with. So we had an interesting coalition. Many people were driven to the coalition as Muslims because they were terrified of what was happening in this country. Because what the United States government had done was work to neutralize what would be domestic opposition to U.S. foreign policy throughout the Middle East, where they were still killing people and maiming people in occupied Palestine, where they were intent upon controlling the petroleum resources of the world and in so doing control the rest of the world, including European imperialist allies, through the war, the attack on Iraq, and the overthrow and lynching of its president, the war that was made against Afghanistan. And so you had a number of people who were terrified because they were having trials in this country. They were arresting people and refusing even to show them the evidence of any crime that had been committed. And people were accepting this because they were easily buying the myth that was being put forth by the Bush regime and others initially that it was all right to take away all of the democratic rights of the people in defense of what they would call terrorism that was coming from other peoples around the world. And so right before, in public view, there was this ongoing process of actually stealing basic democratic rights. This is not an empty discussion for African people. When we talk about democratic rights, we do so while recognizing that even what is characterized as democracy in the United States in this century was something that was defined by the struggle of black people. It was the black liberation movement. It was the struggle of African people, Fannie Lou Hamer, Ella Baker, sharecroppers, and other poor black people that made it necessary for the United States government to even concede that black people should have any rights and democracy should even have a broad reach throughout the general population. And so when we saw the United States government using any pretext to attack basic democratic rights, we understood immediately that it was not some abstract struggle that we were involved in, but it was a struggle that reached deeply into the essence of freedom for African people and other oppressed peoples around the world. So it was absolutely necessary for the coalition to intervene in this process. So there were Muslims who sometimes pushed out of terror who initially joined the coalition, but they were not all people who were terroristic. There was actually the second vice chair of the North Carolina NAACP who initially came on board with the coalition until it was announced and white nationalist attacks began to be launched against this brother that he had to retreat. Some people didn't need an attack for them to retreat. Some people, when they even thought that we were doing something like that, decided they wanted no part of it. And that was all right because they were Obama supporters. Some of these people had been folk who, one of the founding members of the coalition, Comrade Glenn Ford of the Black Agenda Report, had been busily engaging in blistering kinds of critiques and criticisms and actually engaging many of them in debates. This lonely figure in many ways out there, debating forces that many of us had for generations looked up to as icons in the struggle for our freedom. And there were a handful of people. Glenn Ford was one of them. So we pulled together this coalition. We had an extraordinarily successful rally and mobilization march on the White House. And then immediately following that, in January, we came together with the first conference of the coalition. That was in St. Petersburg, Florida. Today is the preparatory conference for our convention that's going to be held November 5th and 6th in Washington, D.C. The anniversary of the first mobilization done by this coalition 7 years ago. And we are going to be talking about important missing element, what has been extremely important as a missing element in the struggle of our people at this point in time, a struggle that really achieved much of its consciousness on August 9, 2014, when poor African working class young people rose up on Canfield Drive in Ferguson, Missouri, and fought the police to a standstill using the slogan, "Kill the police," after they had murdered 18-year-old Mike Brown and left his body rotting on asphalt for 4.5 hours as an example for any black person in this country and certainly in that community where they murdered him. This is what happens to you when you defy white power. And those young people rose up. And when they rose up, it was not just a simple flare, something that was just here and then gone within the next couple of hours. But the resistance lasted long enough to force the United States government to full worldview, to demonstrate its relationship to this African community when it brought out military equipment to try and suppress that movement. It is a movement that I want to remind everybody here that had its origin in the streets of Ferguson, not in classrooms, but in the streets of Ferguson. And it was young, black, working class, young people who did it. The brothers and sisters who are slammed because they sag, they don't speak good English, and the rest of them, that's who fought the police out there. And that's the thing that gave rise to consciousness. It raised the morale of African people throughout this country who had been seeing too many murders of police by our people and had been experiencing the reality of being black in America without any kind of respite. And those young people, no professors out there, just young people who have to face the ubiquitous presence of the police department, this occupying military force in our communities every day, those are the heroes who are not even spoken of anymore today. So we pulled together our first conference in St. Petersburg, Florida, to define what this coalition was. And it was necessary because as soon as the rebellion happened, we saw more opportunities per square inch than any place in the country descend on Ferguson, Missouri. And the U.S. government clearly, and representatives of the U.S. government clearly, were there in Ferguson to try to give direction to this thing that had emerged. And the young people fast lost leadership of this struggle that they had initiated. Young working class people fast lost leadership of this struggle. When Ferguson occurred, it was immediately prior to our convention, the conference of this coalition that happened in this city, and after which the coalition went into Ferguson to intervene in the face of all the charlatans who had descended there and to unite with the African workers there and to try to give some coherent message to what was happening there. Because we didn't need, the movement doesn't need, the struggle didn't need just a whole bunch of people saying anything. We needed to have a movement that had as its foundation the historical struggle of black people in this country that did not begin on August 9th. As significant as August 9th was, 2014, that's not when it started. And it wasn't about body cameras. And it wasn't about police community review boards. That's never what the struggle was about. And we criticized the emergence of a movement that could not even make a demand on the system.
This is one of the few groups that I'm able to speak before because the people in this audience haven't been stymied by the Dred Scott decision. And I guess everyone here knows that decision. A slave, wherever he's caught, can be returned to slavery, whether he's in a free or a slave state. Now, many of our brothers and sisters, when I say are stymied by the Dred Scott decision, is that they take away our right of self-defense. That is armed struggle. My credo is this: the overriding element in every situation or circumstance in a black life is racism. Birth, elementary school, housing, health, food, etc. Black lives have never mattered. except during slavery and other circumstances where money is being made by our laborers for others. The modern death penalty, 80% black, moved lynching indoors. The police, as the army of occupation, have taken lynching outside again. And the lynch mob is the racist system, including the courts and the media. And because the lives of our heroes and sheroes who once protected us in our community do not matter to us, the people, our political prisoners are now dying in captivity. They are tortured and isolated. Only armed struggle can recreate our image in our own minds as well as the minds of others. Wake up, now is the time. Now, I say that and I repeat it because we must bring voice to reality. And our so-called people, when I open up every program with brothers and sisters and I make it clear, my brother and my sister, who is a person who has a unity of purpose, and that purpose is to free concretely every person on the planet. Concretely, not just in words, but in deeds. That's my brother and sister. And when you use this formula to many of the people we are working with today, you will find out that, excuse the expression Mugabe, but it's none but ourselves. And those are the people who have a unity of purpose. Our political education must enable us to predict tomorrow. While our program is archived, and I am so proud that we talk about what happened today, what's going to happen tomorrow, based on our understanding of history. And when it comes true, time after time after time, people say, how do you do that? Very simple, you learn. And I've had great teachers. And one of my teachers was Queen Mother Moore. And I remember the time that she woke me up and she said, you're a teacher. You're supposed to be smart. Do you understand that we are nothing more than a colony within the continental United States? And I says, now, I was a college graduate. I had been teaching school for 8 years, and I thought I was politically hip. And then I began to understand reality. There was somebody voicing reality to me. And I was ready for the lesson. But many people are not ready for the lesson. And I'm going to jump again to Betty, who said to me, Ralph, be careful of the things you say, because you're beginning to limit the groups that you can speak before. But this is the same Betty who said to me, and said on our Blog Talk Radio, who says publicly, we are the Vietnamese, the new Vietnamese, so we better start acting like Vietnamese. And so she's telling me to be careful. And I think of our sister, Lynn Stewart, who states and writes clearly that the Micahs, the Coreys, and the Gavins are our serious shepherds, and we as lesser shepherds are enabled to work only by their efforts. Many of our political prisoners didn't and should not have asked lesser shepherds when and how to act in defense of our freedom. And so my litmus test is with everybody who's supposedly in this movement, how do you see Gavin and the others many years ago who fought for our freedom? They are in jail. Well, the way they think about it, as oppressors, as those who have all of the advantages given to them by oppressors, and they are not willing to give it up, and therefore they do not support our political prisoners. And a young woman said to me, who says spent 7 years in jail fighting on our behalf, on behalf of the movement, she says, you know, Ralph, it is unthinkable for a white political prisoner to go before the board without a lawyer. And we have our political prisoners go before the parole board without lawyers. That's the way it is done. Now, one of our supporters, freedom fighters, Ray Lavasseur, was in jail with one of the political prisoners, and they made a pact. If they got out of jail, the one who got out of jail first, and Ray got out after 22 years, they would form an organization of lawyers and defense committees. And boy, the lawyers, they don't want to hear about a defense committee, because the defense committees tell truth and propagandize, make our political prisoners human, and the lawyers want to keep it in a little box, want to keep it to themselves. And so they made a pact that whoever gets out first would start this organization. And so who did Ray Lavasseur turn to when he got out of jail? He turned to Lynn Stewart. And Lynn Stewart said, of course we must do that. And one of the most liberal, and I use that term advisedly, one of the most liberal legal organizations is the Lawyers Guild. And Lynn Stewart has taken it upon herself with others from Rhode Island, Ben, and so many of the other lawyers within the organizations who have freedom in their hearts and minds, because the organizations themselves and the leadership does not. And so we fought that fight, and I had given up on the Lawyers Guild many years ago while Lynn was in prison, and she called me from prison and said, don't do it, get out there and fight, because there are people within the group who will support political prisoners, but the group itself, the overall group, will not. And so from that day forth, we've been looking for people within any organization, lawyers that is, who will support our political prisoners. And to date, we have 80 lawyers who are willing to work for our political prisoners. Now, the next question is, it gets very technical. And at the last meeting we went to, they went into this person sends to that person, who sends to the next person, who sends to the next person. And, of course, Sister Lynn stood up and said, what about our brothers and sisters sitting in jail? They don't have time for this committee, to that committee, to the next committee. And because of her parole conditions, Lynn Stewart is not allowed to converse or write or have any information dealing with political prisoners or anybody who's been in jail. And she says, you can't write to me, but you can write directly to Ralph, because he has connections with lawyers. My son and my daughter are lawyers. And of course, I can't use Lynn as a connection to political prisoners. And as always, everything is a code word in this society. Get the code. People are sending me letters, and I get technical and political advice from lawyers who are close to me, and we're trying to make this a reality. But it is a mission impossible, as Chairman O'Malley has told us, because the people's minds have been, as a friend of mine once said, they turn the people's minds to mush, and we're trying to turn them back into minds to support ourselves. And so I say, as an example of what has happened, I hear Martin Luther King's name all over the place, but I don't hear Franz Fanon. I don't see that anywhere. So I'm going to say Franz Fanon. Remember that. I'm going to see Henry Highland Garnett. Let your motto be resistance. We have to bring voice to reality. And as we learned back in the 60s, that when the truth of a person's life is more painful than the fiction that they have created for their lives, then the truth becomes the enemy. Yeah. Well, we must tell them the truth. We're in trouble here, folks. Pick your allies carefully and know which ones are real and which ones are not. And at this day and age, we have to be careful of all of those who have been stymied by the Dred Scott decision saying, you shall not use arms in your defense. And that hurts our political prisoners, because every time we say support political prisoners, somebody says, well, gee, didn't that person carry a gun? And I'm saying, or kill a cop. And I'm saying, yeah, Sekou Odinga, who just got out after 23 years, was there to support Assata Shakur to get her out. Don't tell me that we shouldn't support Sekou Odinga, Kwesi Balogun, who died in jail, or many of the others are about to die in jail. And I will conclude with this. In writing and listening to and hearing from political prisoners, Sundiata Kolei, who was one of the great ones, is losing a little heart in jail, because, as he stated many years ago, the faith that our movement would bring us home is greater than any faith of any religion, beyond what they could imagine. He's beginning to lose faith, and that cut me to the quick. I don't know how many years later, after he wrote that letter, and I read it, and Leonard repeated it many times, and now he writes letters, not so strong in his faith. We see Leonard Peltier said, his only hope of being free is that Obama frees him. That cut me worse than a knife could have cut me. His only hope is us. He has to know it. All of the political prisoners have to know it. And we have to get out there and do our job. Thank you. Uhuru.
Yeah, and she put it to the governor's people who run our school district. She put it to them in the decision. She said quite clearly that what they were doing in their arguments and in their case against us was really offensive to free speech, as she put it, offensive to free speech. Here we were speaking out and urging others to speak out and to protest by whatever way they could against the continued destruction of public education for the young majority black and Latino students of Detroit, and the terrible conditions that teachers and students face in the city since the state has been running the school district now for almost two decades. And he's been running it into the ground, dismantling it on the part of charter school operators and private profiteers and anyone who wants money. And the state has just continued under now the Republican governor after the Democratic governor started this. And we were organizing the protests, walkouts, stickouts by students, teachers, and they're going to continue to do that because this is, we have such a unequal, segregated, racially segregated system in Michigan, in Detroit particularly, that people have got to protest. And we were very successful in protesting the spring, and they'll continue, I'm sure, in the fall. We're certainly going to urge more protesting to defeat the governor and politicians, mayor and governor, for destroying our schools.
So the question is, and you seem intent on using this tactic again, the question is, how did it play, A, among other teachers, and B, among the public at large?
Well, the teachers went out and sick out and shut schools over and over again, really the huge popularity of the spike and its huge size compelled the media to have to say some of the truth about the issues, at least some of the facts about the intolerable conditions in the schools got out there. The public, wide and large throughout the state and the country, because it's a national news story, if you recall, was very much in sympathy and support of the teachers. And we just urged in Detroit that parents and students join the fight. I mean, the students in large part have already joined the fight, but there are any, you know, we continually debated by the news media, well, what do you say to the parent who's left with their child? So it's kind of a typical thing with a sudden teacher strike, or any teacher strike, we just said, join the movement. This is quality education. We cannot accept the intolerable conditions anymore. You know, the truth is, the conditions are so bad that schools are often stuck due to all sorts of problems with the schools, even getting power running in the schools for water or anything else. We've got a terrible lead crisis in the water in Flint, and it's been discovered that, you know, so anybody should be surprised here that Detroit schools have many of the same problems of lead in the water and drinking water. And we need to turn to that, too, in this school year, and deal with it. And the only way we're going to get anywhere with that or any of the issues is continuing to civil rights strikes. And the judge accepted that we had, and was actually quite on our side on this in the end of this, in her decision, that we have a right to speak out and organize protests against intolerable conditions of structural inequality and financial and educational inequality. And to try to stop this is to really try to avoid the First Amendment. We're going to continue.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host, Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.
You've been listening to the Black Agenda Report on the Progressive Radio Network. Information for liberation.